For many people, stroke recovery begins with formal rehabilitation, which is vital to restore independence by improving physical, mental, and emotional function. Since the brain has 100 billion neurons, it's the most powerful learning tool in the world, and its ability to recover from insult and injury is quite extraordinary. It's important for you and your family to know that no matter where you are in your recovery journey, there is always hope. In our show today, you'll hear some amazing stories of recovery and learn what makes them different. And don't miss our cooking demo. We're going to feature a wonderful vegetarian dish tonight, so stay tuned. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. I'm Dr. Nerida and I'm glad you've joined us today. Go Healthy for Good is live every Monday to Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Go Healthy Live. And if you want to watch a previous episode or find all of our recipes, then go to our website hopetv.org/gohealthy. After a stroke, the first priority is to stabilize your medical condition and get life-threatening conditions under control. Doctors also take measures to prevent another stroke and limit any stroke-related complications. And then comes rehab. And today on Go Healthy for Good, we look at rehabilitation with a difference. Now, before we start this conversation today, let me introduce you to Heidi. Her story is so powerful. Watch this.
I was born with a DVA and a cavernous malformation. Not knowing this all my life is probably a good thing, but at 13 years old, the symptoms started because my hormones started, and I started getting these severe migraines where I'd go blind on one side, I'd get disoriented, I'd go numb, and I couldn't talk properly or recall words or objects. And they said, oh, you just have atypical migraines, not ever thinking to scan my brain. And so I accepted that all my life. But whenever I felt this way, it was just a migraine. I thought for sure I had MS, I kept getting the weakness, and then I'd get the crawly sensation. It would last for like 3 days. I told the doctor, and he said, oh, you just have fatigue. You know, you have kids, you work full time. And I'm like, okay, that's what it is, you know. Things really started to come to a head in 2010. I was working as a nurse. I couldn't see really well. Everything looked blurry, and I was forgetting things. My right leg was dragging, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't keep my leg up, and I kept tripping, you know, because my leg was dragging. I kept shutting my right hand in drawers, and then I started falling. Within a couple of weeks, my neck was hurting. I was having pressure in my head. It was like one thing after another. And it wasn't just like the weakness would go away. It was like, what, you know, that plus you keep adding things. Things got a little dramatic. All of a sudden, I felt paralyzed one night on the couch. And I called my doctor and I said, you know, something's not right. You know, the same thing that we talked about in 2007 has come back, but it's like way worse. And he said, okay, well, let's get you in for a CAT scan. So I had a CAT scan done and they found a mass right in the center of my brain, 3 centimeters. So it was about the size of a golf ball. They didn't know if it was a bleed or a tumor or what it was, so they determined it wasn't an aneurysm, but it was a arterial venous malformation, which can be just as dangerous, but they didn't know what type of AVM it was. So they sent me home and said, there's nothing we can do, it's in a bad place. You know, we're just gonna watch and wait. And so I went home, and that night I had a seizure. And I went back to the ER, and they said, you're bleeding again. It was my third hemorrhage. I'd had 3 consecutive hemorrhages within a week. And so they transferred me to UCSF, and I realized that my life was about to end. But all I could think about was, who's going to take care of my kids, and how's Dan? Dan can't do this on his own. I just didn't think there was any way he would be okay without me here. And And they pretty much told me that they didn't know if I was going to make it. And they didn't know what they were going to find or if it was going to bleed when they went in. They just said, we don't know the outcome and what really is going on until we get in there and take it out.
Well, joining me today is Dr. John Kelly, board-certified physician in preventive medicine, lifestyle specialist and adjunct faculty at three medical schools, including Loma Linda University. Welcome, Dr. Kelly. It's good to have you back again.
Good to be here with you, Dr. Nerida.
Now, stroke is very common, third leading cause of death in the United States, and every 40 seconds someone has a stroke in this country alone. So very, very common. So tell us, what is going on? When we say the word stroke, it's a lay term, but what's actually happening?
Yes, you know, we're actually encouraging people to think of it as a brain attack because we understand a heart attack better than we do a stroke in many
That's
ways.
True.
And about 80% of strokes are actually the same thing happening in the brain that happen when we have a heart attack. It's a blockage in an artery going to the cells in our brain. Oftentimes, it's one of the carotid arteries here by our neck or vertebral arteries coming up the spinal cord. You can see the graphic there. And when a blockage occurs, it denies blood flow to the cells in our brain, and those cells are damaged. And if it's a stroke, they'll be actually destroyed. We'll talk about TIAs later. If it's temporary, then it's not actually considered a stroke. Now, the other 20%, approximately, is when we have a hemorrhage or a bleed. There's blood.
Like Heidi's story.
Yes, yep. Like Heidi's. And blood in outside the blood vessels is, as you know, is a very toxic and destroying event. In other words, if you bleed on your skin, it's inconvenient. But if it bleed in your brain, it can be very dangerous. It could actually kill you if it causes pressure on the base of the brain.
Right, because we've got a confined space.
That's right.
And the pressure inside the head is very important for brain function.
Yes.
So, yeah, as you say, and sometimes if there's a hemorrhage, they'll drill what we call a burr hole where they release the pressure.
At least the
pressure's gone and the brain can continue to function without that high pressure.
But in any case, even when we relieve the pressure, we still will have the death of cells. And when those cells die, we lose the function that they were performing, and that's what causes the symptoms of stroke.
Right. What are the risk factors for stroke? What if our viewers are watching, they think, oh, my mom or my dad had a stroke. What do I need to watch for? So tell us
what
those things are.
Well, there's a number of risk factors. In fact, I think we have a little scorecard we'll show. But one of the first ones is hypertension. It's high blood pressure. Uncontrolled chronic high blood pressure is dangerous. Yes, I see it on the screen right now. And you can see a second one probably in severity is what we call atrial fibrillation. This is when the atrial chambers of the heart are not beating like they should. It allows blood to create blood clots that can be thrown into the brain.
Then as we go down that list, I'm just thinking that a lot of those things are under our control, aren't they, as you continue down that list?
That's right. I mean, the next few are for sure. Smoking is a risk factor. High cholesterol. You see, since this is a similar disease to what happens in heart disease, anything that will reduce your risk of heart disease in general will also reduce your risk of stroke. So what's good for the heart, chest heart, is good for the brain heart. But lack of activity, physical activity, carrying excess weight, diabetes.
Diabetes is a big one, isn't it?
Yes.
And then also the running in the family.
Family history.
Yeah.
Males are more prone to stroke than females. As we get older, our risk is higher. I think that's more a factor of our lifestyle than is our age, because our age is not an automatic risk factor. Plenty of old people do not have risk of stroke.
True.
And then it can be things like sickle cell disease. People with sickle cell disease are more prone to stroke. So,
yes, because that tends to clog the vessels. Doesn't
that's
it?
Right.
Yeah. And that's something we need to really think about amongst the African American population.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's right.
So if someone was to begin to have a stroke, what might we see? And what would those around them need to do to act?
How would we know? Mm. Yeah, some of the, well, the most common thing that most folks think of is paralysis. But it may not be evident. So there's the little acronym is makes a lot of sense, helps us think about these things fast. But first, it can be in the face. So if you have drooping or weakness on one side of your face, yes, I see the slide there, the graphic. And then the second is the A would be for arms. You would ask someone to smile or to speak, then ask them to raise their hands. And if one or both are weak, mm-hmm. that's an indication. And then smile. No, I'm sorry, speech. I said smiling already about the face. Mm. This is speech, to have them, you know, ask a question, just a normal question. And it's oftentimes, if they can speak, they may not be able to verbalize. So you can test not only the organs of speech, but the brain's ability to verbalize. And then it's important, the timing of these things. If these things are occurring, then it's important to do something as soon as possible.
So time critical. Dial 911.
Absolutely.
Get help ASAP.
And then the typical thing that will happen is it could be eyesight as well, by the way. If you have a loss of sight or you double image, double vision as it's called, cross vision, anything that affects your vision, speech, all of those things can be symptoms. Mm. In women, I was just checking this because I knew we were going to talk about this, and I had forgotten. But when I was looking at some of my medical books, it says in women it could be hiccups, nausea, shortness of breath. So apparently in female gender, there's some other symptoms.
So we really are special.
Absolutely.
Now, tell us, what's the impact of a stroke? And and I think we actually have a CT scan that might sort of show us what that looks like. And
well, at the cellular level here, we see a CT scan. You can see the right side as us looking. You can see the fact that we see a dark area, and this is what happens when we have death or necrosis, or that's, you know, I'm not sure if this particular CT, it looks to me like it's not a bleed, not a hemorrhagic, but an ischemic stroke. But nonetheless, in either case, when the cells die, they begin to putrefy, and you get a mass that causes inflammation. It's a lot of things that happen inside the brain that cause the sequelae or the effects to be worse. In fact, sometimes they get worse over the first few days or weeks before it starts to get better. So it's generally we'll see loss of motor function, strength, weakness, in other words, especially one-sided. Because the nature of the circulation to the brain, there's vessels on each side that supply each half of the brain. And so if something goes wrong with a vessel, it's usually on one side only. And that's one of the cardinal signs that it's a stroke. Yeah.
And it's great that it only affects one side, isn't it?
That's true.
You don't lose both hands or both legs at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Well, coming up next, we'll join Justin in the kitchen for a tasty veggie entree. So stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Reigns forever. He has established his throne for judgment. He rules the world in righteousness and judges the people with equity. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you, for you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you.
Welcome back. Justin, this looks wonderful. What have you got?
Well, we're making stir fry today.
My favorite.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I like it too.
Yeah, because it's just whatever's in the fridge can go in the stir fry.
Yeah, and it's lots of yummy vegetables.
Yeah, it's actually really fun.
Yeah. So.
So what's in it?
Well, it's a bit of a list,
okay.
But it's worth it. It's
All
worth
right.
it. Trust me.
Great.
So vegetable stir fry: 1/4 cup of finely chopped shallots or purple onion, 5 or 6 cloves of garlic, 1 or 2 thumb-sized pieces of ginger, 1 medium carrot, 5 or 6 shiitake mushrooms, 1 small head of cauliflower, 1 small head of broccoli, 1 red pepper, 2 or 3 cups of baby bok choy or some other Chinese cabbage.
Yum, yum.
A little bit of fresh Thai basil, 2 tablespoons of oil, 2/3 cups of coconut milk, 3 tablespoons of Bragg's liquid aminos or soy sauce. We prefer Bragg's, don't we?
We do. Yes. We do. We brag about that.
Nice. 3.5 tablespoons of fresh lime juice and 2 teaspoons of brown sugar. Yes, and all those things blend together in my mouth.
Oh, really?
And then in my belly.
In your tummy.
Yes.
But they taste their stuff here.
They do. They do. Okay, so the first step is make the sauce. So I'm going to let you do
All
that.
All right.
It's basically just putting together our coconut milk.
Coconut milk.
Our Bragg's.
Okay.
Our lime juice and the brown sugar. And
All
we'll
right.
just stir that up.
That's Get that sugar a, dissolve for
yeah,
you while
exactly.
you do the veggies.
All right. That's going to make some yummy, yummy stuff. So I'm going to turn this guy on here and first add a little oil. And the first things that are going to we're going to put on the pan here are the ginger, the onions. Get in there. And the garlic. Oh, thank you. So we'll get that going. This will sizzle and smell delicious for about 1 or 2 minutes. And then we'll add in the next piece, which is going to
this
be just a little bit of that sauce.
Oh, okay. I'm just looking at these, all these lovely brassicas. You know, they've got really potent phytochemicals for cancer.
Now, what do you consider a brassica?
Ah.
I know broccoli, right?
Broccoli. That's a good one to start with, because BR for
right.
brassica and BR for broccoli.
Yeah.
But then all the cousins. So, you know, we'll go this way. So broccoli looks like cauliflower.
Oh, okay.
So you know they're related. But then also all the cabbages. So, and I love... I don't know about where you grew up, but where I grew up, there are lots and lots of Chinese people. So we have this wonderful array of... They're so good at eating their veggies.
Yeah.
And so there's this beautiful array of different pak choy, bok choy, baby
all the choy.
Choice.
You've got your choice of choice.
That's exactly right. So a lot of those things also have it in.
Okay.
And then they also... They have shiitake mushrooms, which are like no other. And one thing about these, I don't know where you get yours from, but I get mine dehydrated and then just soak them in boiling water and they're ready to go. So how do you get
yours? Well, I don't often use the shiitake mushroom.
Oh, you don't?
But if I did, I think I'd go the same route.
Yeah. Mind you, you're a canned guy, aren't you?
Yeah, but canned mushrooms are not my favorite.
No, they're a bit meh.
Yeah, they're a bit meh.
And that's the nice thing about these. They have a really kind of a steaky texture.
Exactly.
Really chewy.
Exactly. Oh, they haven't been sogged out by sitting in a can.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you're probably waiting for me to pour some of this in, aren't you?
These have been going for a couple minutes now. We can really smell that ginger and that garlic.
So I'll put about 1/4 of this in.
Put 1/4 in there.
Oh.
Ooh.
Splattering everywhere. Now what do you need? Can I help?
There's deliciousness just flying everywhere.
Broccoli?
Yeah, go ahead and put that broccoli in there. And there will be, we're going to put the carrot and the mushrooms in there.
Oh, carrots. I'm a bit out of
And the cauliflower.
And the cauliflower. All right.
Doesn't that look good?
Oh, yeah.
All those colors. We've talked about before how the different colors in food are an indication of the nutrients that are in there.
Right.
So if you're eating all the colors, you're getting all the nutrients.
That's right.
That's
exactly right. So this is like a rainbow in there.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
So we'll let this cook for another little bit, and then we'll put some more of that sauce in.
Put some more in. Oh, alrighty.
So put about half of the...
Half of what's left?
Half of what's left.
Alrighty.
Mmm. You guys have smell-o-visions, right? Got that bok choy.
You don't want to cook that too much. It's nice when it's crunchy.
Right. So we'll just let this cook a little bit, and when it's done...
Basil?
The basil goes on top.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, that looks fabulous, and that does not take long to do a meal for so many people, does it?
And it is just bursting with goodness.
Goodness, that's right.
Well, great. I think it's high time to give this a taste.
That smells so good.
It really does.
I can't resist this.
Yeah.
Can I lick
the bowl?
Lick the bowl.
Oh, that ginger.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the ginger.
The coconut. Oh, that is so good.
It is wonderful.
Well, shall we?
Let's please, please taste that.
So here we've got it served with some quinoa.
Some quinoa, yeah.
But we could use rice, we could use noodles, huh?
Mm-hmm. I think quinoa is great.
Do you?
Quinoa, brown rice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, look, a piece of mushroom fell onto my spoon.
Oh, what a wonderful coincidence. Come on now. Oh, dear.
Oh.
Okay, ding.
Cheers.
Vegetables are still crunchy, still bursting with flavor. You've got that sauce on there, the ginger, the coconut milk, the garlic. That is good.
That was so good. You've got to try this recipe. Let's go back to Heidi's story and watch the second part.
Okay, here it is. I woke up 6 hours later and I could move my legs, and they said they got it all. They said 99%, they got 99% of my malformation, and it was life-altering. I'm still struggling today, although I feel like I'm coming back finally 2+ years later. This is right after surgery, 6 hours later, when I woke up. I couldn't open my eyes. Here I am, 36 staples, and that's the bleed in my brain. This is now what it looks like. I was going through these ups and downs after my recovery where I'd get better, but then you'll slip back again. I was at my worst about 3 months ago. One day I had so much pain in my legs, and it was extreme. It was so bad, and I have to take medication, all this stuff, and I just got so depressed. I thought, I can't do this every day. This is not, something has to change, and it has to be drastic. So I decided through my pain to get on my treadmill and run. It's as drastic as it sounds, because I could barely walk. And they even told me at the hospital, you'll never run again. But I literally had to hold on and run. I turned it to 4 and run 4 miles per hour, and I just started running. And the pain went out of my legs for like 2 hours. And from that day on, I've been running and walking 3 days a week. And it just got better and better. And I know God did that, and I know that trusting Him and pushing through that hard time was what I needed, you know. I drink a smoothie just about every day. Now that I've had brain surgery, I think about everything that could be good for my memory or my eyes or my strength. So I put spinach in there and coconut milk and blueberries and this liquid vitamin and bananas and all this stuff, kale, and most people would probably gag. But I notice if I miss it for 3 days, I start to feel bad. Like my weakness feels worse. I'm so sensitive to my weakness. I mean, honestly, if my sleep is off and I'm up late for one night, it can set me back for 3 days. If I don't exercise consistently, I feel like my weakness comes back and it's worse. If I don't eat right, I can tell a big difference. I mean, these things that I didn't notice before, whether it's just naiveness or just things that your body can hang on, is not like it was before. When you've had a stroke, it's like your body is fighting every day to have the energy to get through the day, and everything magnifies after you've had brain surgery. Is it good? Is it making your brain feel good?
We've been talking with Dr. John Kelly about strokes. Now joining us is Sue Paul, an occupational therapist certified in geriatrics through the American Occupational Therapy Association, and she works at the Baker Rehab Group in Central Maryland. Welcome, Sue. It's good to have you on the show today. Now, Dr. Kelly, we were just talking about risks for stroke.
Mm-hmm.
What can people do to reduce those risks? Because we're going to look at good things now. Yeah. Working out how to get over the event.
Well, of course, many of the things we talked about had to do with lifestyle choices, like weight and lack of activity. So obviously, we need to have a good, healthy diet. Mm. In fact, some of the things that Heidi was talking about, those you were just talking about with foods of color and berries and so forth, activity, regular activity, good sleep. But some of them, like atrial fibrillation, there's not a lot we can do. We need a medical checkup to make sure that our heart rate is correct and right. And if not, then we can get something that will help keep our blood thin so we don't get those clots.
And it's easy to check for atrial fibrillation by just feeling your pulse. And if it's irregular, then that's a really important sign.
The more prominent types you can find, but I would, you know, there's
you
some.
Want to get your doctor
you really
to
need
check
to get
it.
A doctor to check.
Oh yeah.
Don't
sit at
just
home
do it
with
for
an
yourself.
Irregular heart.
Right.
Yeah.
And it does tend to run in families. So if you have a history of irregular heart rate beats in your family, you should have that checked out.
Mm.
But you know, I think that one of the key things is think about what you would do to avoid heart disease and improve circulation. And this is going to, in general, be helpful to avoid risk of stroke.
And a big risk factor is blood pressure, and so you can't tell just by sitting, looking at it, feeling how you feel sitting in the chair, what your blood pressure is. So it's really important to go to your doctor and
know what your blood pressure is.
Know what
know
it
your
is.
Cholesterol is.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Now, Sue, you must see a lot of people who are recovering from things like stroke.
Yes, too many.
Too many.
Too many.
So just walk us through the process from when somebody suffers a stroke. When do they start? When are they able to start rehab? How long does that take? That whole process. Just tell us about it.
Well, from the first time they have a stroke, they're usually in an acute care setting, and therapy is called in as soon as the patient's medically stable. And our priorities at that time are skin protection, because they're laying in a bed, and you know you don't need a bed sore on top of that.
Right.
We want to get them out of
that
bed.
And you're not able to move yourself around.
Correct. And your sensation can be impaired, and you wouldn't know that you're having a lot of pressure issues.
Mm.
Another thing is aspiration is a risk at that time. So getting the patient up out of the bed as soon as possible is one of the priorities in that acute phase.
Mm.
Also, teaching the caregivers how to handle somebody who might have a hemiparesis on one side. You know, you don't want to pull on an affected arm or, you know, and the patient, as they're waking up, tends to be very sleepy and has trouble with alertness. So those first critical days are about getting them up and, you know, awake again.
Right, because you can lose that gag reflex.
And the swallow reflex.
To guard your airway and swallowing and things. So, yes, that uprightness is really important. Then when actual rehab starts, when would that actually start, the real hard work?
Well, you know, as soon as they're able to be transferred to some sort of more rehabilitative setting, it would be in a rehab hospital or a subacute nursing facility, then they start daily therapy, depending on their needs, of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy, if that's needed as well.
Mm.
Usually twice a day, all day long. I mean, they're getting a lot of intensive work for, you know, maybe a month.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's you know, we have limitations in our healthcare system of how long they're able to stay.
And that's a really important point, is the healthcare system can't continue forever.
Right.
And that's why do you involve family during that process?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Because, you know, figuring out what their post-discharge situation is going to be is part of what we do, and we become, you know, case managers and social workers of, you know, putting together the equipment in the home and who's going to stay with them, and if there's a spouse or, you know, and they have to go back to work, arranging for outpatient therapy if that's needed, or home health. You know, there are some options.
Mm. And how quickly do you see progress in that rehab?
Gosh, everybody, it's such a variable thing, because the stroke can happen in any section of the brain and can cause a variety of different problems. So, you know, initially we see a lot of improvement in those first few weeks, and you have a sense of maybe how things are going to go. Mm. So if somebody had a completely flaccid arm when they were first had the stroke, they might get some gross movement back. It's sort of an abnormal pattern. So therapy would work to try to normalize the tone and get the arm moving smoothly. Mm. But that can take years to actually accomplish that.
Really? So, in fact, rehabilitation should keep going. Have you ever seen someone recover fully, not from just a TIA, the temporary, mm-hmm. but a more dense stroke?
You know, for my own patient, no, I haven't, since I don't deal with rehabilitation and with stroke patients. But I do know patients when I was in training, that definitely I saw have full recovery. But I will say those were the ones that had less severe motor dysfunction or speech problems. But I know that it is possible for us to have full recovery. But as Sue was saying, it takes years and persistent effort, and our health insurance ends after a few weeks, generally. I don't know of anyone that gets more than a few weeks in the U.S.
Wow.
And so it really requires family or friends and persistence on the part of the patient. We were talking earlier about how comorbidities can really limit that. Because, for example, if someone has a disease that prevents them from exercising, being active, it can be almost impossible to recover, because you've got to move. You've got to have activity to have recovery.
Right. Good point. Coming up next, we'll show you some practical tips that'll help you in your recovery process after a stroke. Sue's going to show us those. But first, let's take a look at today's medical news report. Headlines today: long-term weight loss secret, mammography causes overdiagnosis, and extended tamoxifen extends life. Researchers have found that simply replacing high-fat foods with low-fat alternatives helped people lose over 3 pounds in weight, lowered their blood pressure, and improved cholesterol levels, even though none of the participants was dieting or trying to lose weight. The weight came off quickly and was not regained for at least 7 years. Sounds easy, doesn't it? Why don't you give it a try? An observational study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last week confirms the findings of many previous studies. Screening mammograms have increased diagnoses and increased surgery for breast cancer, but have not necessarily saved many lives. The author of the review theorizes that nearly one-third of all newly diagnosed cancers are actually overdiagnoses. That's caused vigorous debate within the medical community. Women with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer often take tamoxifen, a hormone-blocking agent, for 5 years after initial surgery. A study published in The Lancet this week shows that continuing tamoxifen until 10 years almost halves the risk of recurrence and death, especially after year 10. There was, however, a substantial increase in the risk of thromboembolism and of uterine cancer. So if you opt to prolong tamoxifen therapy, you might speak with your doctor about having regular uterine ultrasonography. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's medical news report.
The Bible has so much practical counsel about the Christian life, what it means to be a good steward of the resources that God has entrusted in our care, how to have healthy marriage relationships or relationships with our children, relationships with people around us. The Christian life, that's our topic this week on Hope Sabbath School.
welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. Dr. Kelly has kindly agreed to pretend to be a patient for us just now. Sue is his therapist, and we are going to go through rehab. His left arm is the arm that's affected. Mm-hmm. So, Sue, we see that the left arm is just hanging there. What do you want to tell us? Now?
Typically, in an early stroke, when this whole arm is flaccid, it's very heavy. I mean, an arm weighs, you know, maybe 7 to 15 pounds.
Wow.
And it's just gravity pulling down on that joint. So we have a lot of orthopedic issues that could have result also just from the stroke. Mm. So being conscious of those complications, we'd want to try to support the arm
as much as we can.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, a lot of people don't even attend to that side. They have a neglect or an inattention to the affected side. So he might not even be aware.
So they tend to just look to the good mm-hmm. side.
The world exists over there.
And often they actually lose that part of their vision, don't they? That their visual field just stops here and this.
Yep.
And so it's a matter of.
And then you have a decline in sensation as well. So he doesn't even feel it.
So there's no feedback coming
through. Right. So this arm, you know, a lot of times we see it get tangled in the wheelchair wheel. It could be sitting on it. It doesn't get taken care of very well. So one of the first things, my priority, other than positioning, is having the patient and their caregivers treat it like a baby. Like, this is your baby. You need to bring your baby with you everywhere you go, and don't leave your baby behind.
Okay.
So that way, at least I can always say, sometimes I put a little smiley face on it. Where's the smiley face? And they have to look and find their hand because it's such a foreign object suddenly. It doesn't even feel attached. So that's in the early stages where this is very flaccid.
Okay. So now you've got some things here that you might...
Can I
work with? Yes, you may. You may.
So my approach for dealing with a hemiplegic arm would be to try to get it involved in function as soon as possible, even if it's useless. Mm-hmm. As long as the brain is attempting, that's neurons firing. They might not get through, but if you want to have any kind of neural recovery, then we need to really make sure the brain is firing. So I tell them all the time, I know your hand isn't moving, but think about it, visualize it, see if you can make it move. And they get frustrated because it doesn't move.
Right.
But either way, so then we work on getting some successes as far as function goes by involving it in a task where they just have to use it as a prop.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I wanted him to peel this banana, can you see okay? I would ask him to hold the banana in the good hand and prop it against this hand. Even if this hand can't grab it, mm-hmm. he can prop it there while he tries to peel it with the other hand.
All right.
If he gets a little bit of gross function in his hand, then actually he could actually grasp it a little bit.
Right.
Although it's weak. It could even help him. Although it's weak, it might get some weak grasp there.
Right.
And use it functionally. Let this hand do all the work.
Okay.
Okay, but this one's at least involved. And it's centered in front of him in midline, so he can see it.
Right.
He can see, you know, so that's more visual feedback for the brain to try to repair those pathways because he's using his visual sense as well.
Mm.
So that's how we kind of facilitate recovery in those earlier stages.
Okay, and I see you've got a toothbrush.
I do.
Well, that's going to be more challenging.
Yes, all along the paradigm, you know, of trying to increase function in this hand, once he can stabilize something, meaning he could hold this toothpaste and unscrew it with this hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a stabilizing assist that this hand can do.
Right.
Then I would have him try to do it the other way. So stabilize it in the good hand.
As he becomes more functional.
And this will be a series of failures because it takes a lot of coordination to do something like that. So maybe even loosen the cap a little bit to give him a little bit more success.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll figure it out. It's a compensatory thing. Sometimes people go straight to their teeth. They can do it that way. But I'm trying to get the hand involved.
Yep.
So then, you know, he could hold this in this hand
and apply it
with the other hand.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Eventually, he would be able to, let me put this down, you would support this arm and bring it up and brush your teeth.
Wow.
Okay. Yes. So that arm is engaged. I might be, as a therapist, supporting his shoulder because, again, we might have some weakness back here. So I'm supporting this while he's doing the task.
Mm.
Okay.
So that would be something that a family member could learn to do to just help to... do tasks with both hands.
Just because it doesn't work does not mean it's useless. And trying to involve it in functional tasks for the duration, I mean, this is a lifetime thing where you're constantly going to be struggling with involving it. So you can choose to ignore it and get on with using your right hand as much as you can, or you can set to the task of involving that left hand again to get some neural recovery.
Right, and we've seen with Heidi's story where she was really persistent and pushed through it that she actually regained recovery.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah. So, now, tell us about the cup.
Same sort of principle. At the very least, I want him to try to bring both hands to his mouth. He could easily drink with just his right hand, but
right.
It's the same sort of thing. I want to support him if he needs support and help him bring that hand up
right.
to the mouth. Okay, normal function, as normal as possible in every task. So, and eventually this hand will get clumsy and stronger where he can try to do it actively on its own.
Right.
And then you're going to just guard with that hand. You know, so you're going to try to bring
save
it up.
The spills.
Uh-huh, and just have that right hand just in case.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for feeding as well, as the coordination improves in the left hand here, he could try to hold it, even using a gross grasp, where he's, just wrapping his hand around it and trying to get the food up.
Mm. To just involve it.
Mm-hmm, involve it as much as he can. And for what he can't do, he would support it with this hand and get it done. Okay, and people get frustrated, you can't blame them.
No.
But if they could do a percentage of their meal on their own without help, then that help kind of...
So a percentage of every meal and
a realistic goal, something that's not too taxing. So you want to set them up for some success because it's a long road. It's and if you could do 50% of your meal this week, maybe next week you could do 75% of your meal.
Right.
You know.
Well, that sounds great. Well, in just a minute, I'm going to answer some questions that you've sent me during our previous shows. But first, let's watch another Ageless Advantage spot. Enjoy.
Heart disease is not just a man's disease. A study reported in the New England Journal of Medicine compared two groups of middle-aged women. The first group had 80% fewer heart attacks than the second. What was the difference? The first group were all a healthy weight, did not smoke, and exercised at least 30 minutes a day. These things, maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, and exercising, were the triple advantage against heart disease. A healthy heart is another ageless advantage.
We've got a great offer for you. If you call now and ask my experts a question on stroke recovery during our live broadcast, we'll send you this lovely book, Celebrations, for free. So call us now, 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. And if you're calling from overseas or texting your questions, the number's 301-960-5144. Or you can even Facebook your questions during the live show. The free book offer, you can Facebook your questions, by the way, anytime, but we'll be able to answer them live if you Facebook them now. The free book offer is restricted to viewers of our live show here in America. If you've missed previous episodes, you want to get our recipes, visit our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. We're also on iTunes. You can download our podcast there. Just look for it on iTunes. I want to thank you for your comments and your questions. And I have a question here. Last week we covered the subject of domestic violence. And Pearson called and asked, is there hope for a person who was a victim of domestic violence for the scars to go away? I've sought help from Christian counselors. I've prayed a lot, asked for prayer, but I still feel very depressed at points. Is there hope for me? Pearson, I want to encourage you, yes, there is hope, and I think the steps that you've begun to go through are great. You've asked this question in the context of Christianity, so I'm going to answer your question in that context also. You've been to a counsellor, that's great, and you may still need to go for more counselling. Though I sense that you're not feeling progress at this point. So what I would say is, make a list of, by the way, you did not deserve any of this. Many times, as victims, we feel partly responsible. We feel guilt. We feel shame, remorse. But definitely as a victim, you feel humiliated and exploited. Those all bring up emotions. And what you need to do is perhaps make a list of all the emotions that you experienced during that time of abuse. And I'm so glad you're no longer in that situation. And then pray specifically over each of those emotions and ask for freedom and release from those emotions because they're binding you. Now, many times you may see someone define depression as anger turned inwards. And hey, let's face it, it's very human to react with anger. And if we can't express it, we turn it in on ourselves, and that can become depression. So that anger is also an emotion that's in there. So what I would say is offer those emotions to God, and then ask for the strength to have forgiveness in your heart. If you forgive your perpetrator, it won't change his life at all. But if you forgive, it changes your life completely. And so pray for a forgiving heart, and then you will really, truly be able to find freedom. Well, I thank you for sending your questions. Keep them coming. If you've got a question on stroke recovery, our number's 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. Now let's go back to Heidi's story. Watch this.
Something that happened 6 weeks ago. I had gone over to Jamie and Dale's house, and the week before, I was feeling really bad. And Jamie and Dale have a go-kart. And the kids were going crazy, and I have been, since my surgery, no, I can't do that. No, I can't jump. No, I can't go upstairs. I mean, literally, like anything that jars my brain, I'm like, oh no, I'm totally scared to do it. And I'm watching the kids for like an hour, I'm struggling, going, I want to get on that. I need to get on that. And so finally I look at Jamie, I go, I need to go for a ride on the go-kart. And she said, okay. She goes, do you want to drive? I said, yeah. So we got in there and we strapped in. And so I did a few circles around their property. And then after like three laps, I said, I think we need to do some donuts. And so we started like spinning donuts. Like I was going crazy just around this tree and like slamming on the brakes, and we were spinning out. And she was laughing so hard, she was like just tears. And then that same day I got on my bike and we went for a bike ride. Things that I would never do up till now. And that was probably the best day of my whole life since my surgery. And that really turned things around for me. So laughter, like, was huge. I needed all of that excitement and the laughter and just to push myself. You know, I ran on the treadmill. Now I can get on my bike. Why not? I mean, if I could run on a treadmill for 10 minutes, I can get on my bike and go right up a hill. I need to let go of my fears and just enjoy myself for once. I know I'm never going to be back to the way I was, and that's fine, because I actually feel blessed that I went through this. I feel like if I didn't go through this, I'm just going to walk through life and have no clue of what people go through and be naive to, you know, people that suffer. I never thought I'd have a brain hemorrhage. Never. Life was just passing me by before. I was just going through life, normal, working hard, coming home, taking care of my kids. You kind of forget, you know, your purpose. And I've learned that to slow down and not work so hard, because in the end it's not worth it. I could have died in surgery, and to look back and go, all I lived for was to work, should be home with my kids and should be enjoying life and teaching them about God as much as possible. And I've learned not to be afraid to share God. I know that if I weren't sharing the Word of God with people, I wouldn't be, you know, using what I've been through. That's really where I found peace, like real peace, like to get me through the hard times. I just think he had a plan for me in this whole thing, and it took a while for me to realize that. Every day I learn something from this, every day.
To learn something every day is just wonderful to hear. Her life was really brought down to real basics, and she's just picked herself up and pressed on by the help of God.
Very encouraging story.
It is. Now, you have some stories of people who've made similar amazing recoveries and what we've learned from that. Yeah. Why don't you share one of those?
Yeah, you know, I've been so impressed with the neuroplasticity of the brain. And this, you know, in my training, I remember I was basically taught, like many of us were in medical training, that the brain was anatomically assigned, and if you've lost a certain function in part of the brain, then that was gone. But neuroplasticity has discovered the adaptability and how the brain can change what specific parts of the brain do. And so I wanted to share this story about Professor Pedro Baquirita. Mm-hmm. And at age 65, Professor Pedro had a massive stroke. He was in a wheelchair, paralyzed on the left side, affected his speech. In fact, years later, the autopsy showed that he had over 90% destruction of the brain stem including areas of the cortex, the surface of the brain. So, but the part that's remarkable was his son, George, was in medical school at the time and didn't want his father to just sit in a nursing home, brought him to where he lived and spent hours working with his father. In fact, he tells how he had him crawling around because he was weak on the left side. Mm-hmm. And so he got him to crawl against the wall. As Sue was demonstrating earlier, even when that limb is useless, or you might even not even be aware of it, you have to consciously think, where is my arm?
Right.
It's important that you involve it, that you move it, that even if passive movement has shown to stimulate neuron formation and reorganization. Mm-hmm. So,
because it's really the wiring that's
right.
So we just need to rewire that body part.
Well, you know what's so exciting about that is, Dr. Nderda, is that we have discovered that our brain is continually rewiring like the bone. You know, we know that the osteoblasts, osteoclasts are continually reforming our bones. That's why when the astronauts go into space and weightlessness, their bone density changes and they come back to gravity, it changes again. Same thing is actually happening in our brains, and we're not aware of it. We're continually, reaffirming or reforming those connections. But anyway, back to Professor Pedro. Mm. So he actually was able to fully recover. It took about 3 years, and he was able to go back to work as a professor. Worked for a few years before his untimely death at age 63, about eight or nine years later, and that's when his son had the autopsy done. And they were amazed at the damage that was still in his brain, mm-hmm. but he had recruited and other areas of the brain to take over those functions. That's just remarkable.
Wow. So there's hope. Now, we have a caller on the line, Myrene from Florida. Myrene, welcome to Go Healthy. What's your question for us this evening?
Okay, my question is, what's the best food that would target a person's brain that's recovering from a stroke?
Good question. Dr. Kelly, good food for brain.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the kinds of foods that will help the brain are known to be foods that are high in color and high in antioxidants. We think of berries.
Like Heidi was having in her breakfast.
That's right.
That smoothie.
Mm. That's right. And vegetables of color. The darker the color in general, the mm-hmm. more the nutrients and the richer the nutrient. And another thing I think that's really important is the making sure that we're getting plenty of the B vitamins in our diet. Mm. These are so important. So I recommend, if there's any question, actually take a one-a-day supplement just to make sure. Mm. But the best source of nutrients is whole foods.
Right.
So I'm not suggesting you can take the vitamin and
instead,
forget the food.
No.
Need them both. And another very important thing is activity. Amazingly, Dr. Rady has a book out called Spark, and it's remarkable how he documents that physical activity actually changes the anatomy and the functionality of the brain. So exercise and physical activity is very important, too.
More important than food, probably.
It may be.
By the sounds of it.
Maybe.
Now we have another caller, Myrie from Illinois. Myrie, what's your question?
Hi.
Welcome to Go Healthy. What's your question for us?
My question is, what is the difference between having a stroke and having a TA? And if you have a TA, does that indicate you will later have a stroke?
A TIA is where the brain recovers in a short space of time, usually within hours. And it really is like a mini stroke. And what sets you up for TIAs also sets you up for strokes. I think you
agree
with
that.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah, I was TIA technically, and it's a transient ischemic attack. It reverses its effects within 24 hours. But as she said, as the caller said, it is a known risk factor for stroke. In fact, a majority of people, I think it was 40% who have a TIA, will have a stroke within a few days. So you must not ignore a TIA. That's like an early warning. That's like chest pain for heart disease.
Right.
It's early warning. Just get it checked and taken care of.
Right. And that's a good point. Now, Kathleen also called and she asked, do strokes come before heart attacks? And Kathleen, not necessarily. Some people get strokes, some people get heart attacks. It just depends where the blockage is in your blood vessels and whether blood is flowing through, whether that blockage breaks off. Which one breaks off first? Typically speaking, if you have plaque, atherosclerosis in your blood vessels, that's throughout your body. So it just depends where the action happens first as to whether you get a stroke or a heart attack. But if you've had one, you're at risk for the other as well. Now, here's a text message. I've recently had a stroke. I'm slowly recovering. Why do I feel so tired when moving around the house?
Is that for me?
Yes.
That's a, you know, if you think of a stroke, it's a tremendous insult to the body. It's healing takes time. Healing takes energy. It pulls all of your resources, you know, to that area to heal it. So I expect that fatigue is a huge issue for a lot of people recovering from stroke. So my advice would be, as far as energy conservation and pacing yourself and picking the time of day where you have the most activities to do, do those when you feel the best. Space them out, plan ahead, you know, all those things. Ask for help. Some people don't like to do that as well. You know, and just give it time. You need to be patient. You get, you know, extra frustrated when you're not able to do what you just want to do. So you really have to have a sense of, you know, I'm just going to do what I can do today and tomorrow will be incrementally better.
I want to thank you, Sue, for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you again, Dr. Kelly.
Good to be here.
Now, if you or someone you love is on that long, slow journey of stroke recovery, I hope that what you've learned today has inspired you to keep striving for full recovery. Don't give up hope. If Heidi did it, you can too. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. Tomorrow we've got a very special guest in the studio to discuss some of the secrets the government doesn't want you to know about health policy. Till then, go healthy for your own goodness, and I'll see you next time.